Don't make too much noise with that knife, though, because it'll count. That mic is very sensitive.
Yes, you know? Yes, yes.
This is Mary Cadden in Verscoyle Court. You're not a Dublin woman at all, of course.
No,
Mary.
Country.
Tell me about your background.
Well, I came of farming people in County Roscommon. My father was a small farmer and my mother helped him on the farm.
What size farm were you?
About 35 acres, I'd imagine.
Mixed farm. Days.
Mixed farming, yeah.
Mm. Could you make a living off that in those days?
Well, just about. My father was a good cattleman. He dealt in cattle. And that really was what kept him going. He was a good buyer and a good seller. He knew his cattle well and that really kept him going.
Were you a big family?
We were eight.
Eight children?
Four boys and four girls.
Are they all still alive?
They're all still alive, yes. And well, thanks for
a few years on now.
Yes, yes.
And what about yourself? What was your role in farm life in those days?
Well, I helped, I suppose, in my own little way.
The boys would have been out with your father?
The boys would be out with my father, and I remember at the age of 10 I was... I say I milked my first cow when I was about 10 years of age. And Saturdays you stayed home and you stayed in and you helped clean up the house and have everything ready for the men for going out on Sunday. Father's clothes had to be clean and shoes polished and your brother's the same. We used to feel a little bit resentful about having to prepare our brother's clothes.
Yes, the girls were... a kind of junior race in those days. The boys were
well. The reason for it was really that you see they were out working with my father, and they wouldn't be finished until late.
Yeah.
And my mother reckoned that well, as it was part of our duty to have them ready for Sunday morning. Otherwise, well, probably some of us would be out playing or something like that. So,
well, your role was to help your mother, really.
Well, as far as I possibly could. Then when I was a little bit older, I mean, I used to help bake bread and wash the clothes, and clothes in those days, of course, were washed in the wash tub. No such thing as washing machines.
What about the food on the table? It was mostly from the farm, was it?
Well, that was all from the farm.
Was it?
Yes. Well, we bought the flour, of course.
Yeah.
Sometimes we'd have some of it milled. We had enough corn. But we had good, plain food. We always had very good potatoes. Killed our own pigs. A couple of pigs a year. They were lovely.
Yeah.
And then we had our own turnips, our own cabbage, and as I said, those beautiful potatoes. And the bread was lovely. We had all our own buttermilk, we had our own cows, made our own butter. So you had your own buttermilk.
So you were self-sufficient to it.
And if you hadn't, and then we had all our own eggs, of course.
Yeah.
And if you hadn't, just when calving time came for the cows, you looked around to see if all the neighbours had milk. And they did the same when their cows calved. If you hadn't milk, they brought you some. And there was a great community spirit then amongst the people.
You got on well with your neighbours always?
It was unheard of that neighbours didn't agree. Neighbours had to get on well because there was nobody else to help them. I mean, doctors were hardly ever called in. Childbirth was usually attended by a neighbour. All the ups and downs, if one man was sick, all the neighbours fed his cattle. Cattle never did so well as when the farmer...
The boss was sick.
The boss was sick because every farmer kind of went and fed them.
Right.
And looked after them, and they all looked after one another. It was a wonderful spirit. I think it's still there, a lot of it is still there today.
What about amusements? They were fairly simple, I suppose.
I think
crossroads dancing and all that.
Yes, so if you got a house that had... give you a dance. Rinboy dances was the thing to look forward to at Christmas. All the lads used to go out on the rinboys and all the money they'd collect, they bought a half barrel.
Mm.
And then they got a house to have the dance in. They'd look around for who had the best kitchen floor. Our house usually qualified for that.
Mm. And this be a flag floor?
Cement floor.
Cement.
All flags are cement, now they're wet and fussy. And the girls were all asked. and the men had to pay. If they were drinking, they probably paid 1 and 6, and if they weren't, they might get in for 6p or a shilling.
Yeah.
And the music was all supplied from the local talent. We had some wonderful dances in our house. This is when I was older, I remember them, and there would be at least 4 fiddles and 4 flute players playing together. Now, you might say, no, just a reasonable sized kitchen.
Yes.
It was fantastic music.
Well, I suppose marriages took place locally between the local boys and girls. It would be rare to go outside to find
them. They were usually local. Wouldn't go very far outside.
But I suppose, as happens up in that part of the country, a lot of the men stayed single.
Even a lot of them did stay single, yes. Well, I suppose at the time I was growing up, girls were getting a little bit more independent. And when they came to about 18, a lot of them took off. And
the 1930s.
I left home in 1935. And really, once I had gone away, the local interest was lost as far as marriage was concerned. I think they reckoned you were a bit flighty.
Yes, quite.
Once you had left home, like, I mean, that one wouldn't...
Wouldn't settle.
That one wouldn't settle. So she wouldn't.
Yes.
So it means steer clear of her. It's all right if she got her while she was still at home. But if she slipped through the net...
Would you have liked to have married a farmer?
I would have loved to have married a farmer.
Would you?
I would have loved a farm. I was very, very fond of farm life. But there you are. Then I married, didn't have a farm, so...
Well, now, when you were 18, you took off for where?
For London. There were absolutely no jobs to be got in Ireland at the time. I remember one day getting, I think it was the Independent, and looking down through the ads. Jobs vacant. The only thing I could see that would suit me at 18 years of age was a job as a doctor's receptionist in Dorking for £12 a year, live in. They had 5 children. And I reckoned, as the eldest girl of a large family, I wouldn't be able to send much to my mother out of £12 a year and look after 5 children and the doctor's doorstep and knocker and what have you, and probably be his receptionist and what have you. And I felt that that wage was very, very small.
So what did you do instead?
So I saw an ad for a post in London nursing, and I applied for that and I got it.
That must have been an enormous change for you, coming from rural Ireland.
It was a very, very big change. Because you were literally afraid to go out. Excuse me. You know, there weren't many places that we could go, because we didn't know them. We didn't know the areas very well until we got to know them.
What hospital were you in?
I was in a mental hospital on the outskirts of London. St. Bernard's, still there.
And I suppose it was a pretty severe regime, the hospitals and that.
Well, we had a good motherly, strict matron. She was really all that. And she looked on us as being her big brood. But she took good care of us.
You lived in, of
course? Well, we lived in, yes. And we got all our meals in. And you had to have your meals. But I was checked that you didn't go without your meals. You had to go into the dining room and have your meals. And you had your laundry all done. And
what kind of wage did you get there compared with your £12?
Well, the wages when I started there was £54 a year.
Oh, that's a big increase in what we're up at here.
It was a big difference, really. And I'd say the work was even easier than it would have been at home. The hours were long, but the time off was quite good. And
did you have many Irish girls?
Oh, yes. Every county in Ireland was pretty well represented. Maitre was very fond of Irish girls, actually. She reckoned they were very good workers. So she really employed a lot of Irish girls.
Did you get married while you were in London?
I did. I met my husband about
actually about 2-3 years later after going over there at a dance one night.
But you couldn't meet anybody.
So I think we fell hook, line and sinker there and then. And about 3 years later we got married.
This would have been coming up to wartime, I'd imagine.
Yes, we got married in 1940. The war was on then. We were married 3 weeks before the Battle of Britain started. So that was quite an experience to see the fire of London from our doorstep.
Where were you living at that time?
I was living on the outskirts of London at the time, near Heston Airport.
That must have been quite a dangerous place to live, actually.
Ah, every place.
Well, Heston was particularly, that was a military airport.
It was, yes. But you didn't think of it as being dangerous. You lived by the hour. I mean, you look back and you think, well, I'm still alive. Marvelous, like I'm still alive, I'm here. And that was it. That was absolutely wonderful.
And the ordinary people seemed to have been extraordinarily brave.
The ordinary people were wonderful. Really wonderful. I remember once times were very bad. We didn't know what was going to happen next. And Churchill made one of his famous speeches and when he said that the war would only be won by blood, sweat and tears. And every next morning when I went out to work, everybody had their chin up about 2 inches higher than it was the day before. And they never rumbled and they never looked back. And every one of them took that to heart, what he had said. And it was blood, sweat and tears. Absolutely dreadful, you know, what the people put up with. Because your food was rationed very, 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 very strictly. And people queued if you stood to decide whether you were going to cross the road or go looking for something. There was a queue behind you. You had a stand on your own. And people just gathered. That person must be queuing for something. Something's coming along. Like that was very funny. In the end you were just afraid to stop anywhere because there would have been a queue behind you.
How did you get around London when it was half wrecked? Did you travel by public transport?
Oh yes, you could travel by public transport. I mean, luckily for getting to work I cycled. But apart from that, there was the trains and the buses. Trains ran all the time. And so did the buses. They were great.
Were you still nursing at this stage?
I nursed until just before my first baby was born, which was 1942, and then I gave it up.
Why did you give it up?
Well, you weren't allowed to stay on then when you were expecting a baby.
Even
you wasn't allowed then.
There must have been a great demand for nurses.
There was, but this, you see, first, at the time I got married actually, no, which was in 1940, in July, you couldn't stay on then and get married. I had to resign to get married. So a couple of weeks later, Matron decided she'd have to take back some of the married girls. And that was how I got back nursing again. But before that, you had to leave. No matter what job you were at, you had to leave. Then women started to get out into munitions and driving buses and doing the milk rounds and the bread rounds. And women took over the men's jobs. Farming. Oh, you should see the girls out weather now, like what we've had this month of February. I saw them out there around Heston on their tractors. And how they could stand it, I don't know. They were English girls who were brought up, you know, for office jobs and bank jobs and what have you. And they were absolutely wonderful girls. Wonderful.
So what happened to you when you gave up nursing then? What did you do after that? Come back to Ireland?
When the baby was 9 weeks old, I brought her over to Ireland because the bombing was very bad in London at the time, and my husband wouldn't allow me to stay over there with her. So he sent us over to Ireland, and I stayed in Ireland until she was nearly a year. Then he came home on the holidays, and I went back with him.
This was still in wartime?
Oh, this was still in wartime, yes.
Did you bring your baby back with
you? No, I left the baby in Roscommon. I wouldn't be allowed to take her back.
By your own people?
By my mother. Yeah. She wouldn't part with her. Well, none of the family would, because they just loved the baby. And the baby was happy there, and there was that. So there was no point in bringing her to London, because for one thing, I remember going back, I had ideas of taking her back, now fully that you mentioned it. And I tried to get a flat. And when I was asked, had I any children, I said, yes, I had a baby. I couldn't deny having a baby, because I had her. I didn't feel that I should deny having her. Oh, no, 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 no. You don't take in children. But I said, she's not here. It doesn't matter. Being married and having no child, I would be taken in. But being married and having a child that was evacuated or otherwise, I wouldn't be allowed in. I didn't want children. They were very strict on that. Mm. Like their house, Englishman's home was his castle. And they didn't want... One, this lady said, oh, but she said, look at my flowers, she said. Your baby come along, she says, and she will pick those flowers. It's the flowers growing by the path. Did she have a garden full of flowers down my home to enjoy herself with, so she was better left there.
So you went back to London, you and your husband?
Yes.
And did you go back nursing?
No. I thought I would like a change, and that the kind of nursing I was doing was not really... I didn't consider it work of national importance, which was really priority then. And I eventually got a job in an aircraft factory.
What were you doing there?
I was in the experimental department. Well, when planes would crash, we'd be taken in and they would be stripped. And when they got the logbook, the black box, they would find out what was going wrong before the pilot had to make his notes before it crashed. Because pilots were always killed at that stage. And I suppose it's still ours during the crash. But they worked then on the information that was in the black box. And I was on part of that work of making the new parts for, you know, the made a new drawing for it and different improvements, changes.
Hmm. So they would work out from the black box what had gone wrong and then they'd fix
as
that
as far as possible.
And did they always fix it right?
Or? Oh, no, 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 no. I'm sure there were an awful lot of lives lost in...
trying out these experimental things.
All these lovely young fellows, you know, very sad. But one of the very sad things about it.
Well, did you get good money at that job?
The money was good. At that stage now, money was very good at that. I mean, well, we considered it very good anyway.
And what was your husband doing?
My husband was also in an aircraft factory. He was out at where the present Heston Airport is now. There was an aircraft factory out there, and he worked out there. Maybe you should. When I was about to be married, I was looking for a flat, and. I had my eye on a block of self-contained flats. There was just six flats and a three upstairs, three downstairs. It was two blocks like that. And every time I used to pass it to my husband, we weren't married at the time, but I'd love to live there. So I went to see several flats and I didn't like them at all. And eventually I got the top half of a house, of a new house. A couple who had it, like, could only afford to occupy the bottom part. So the man who owned the house, a young man, he said he would do it up as I liked, and he did. And I went round to see it, and I was delighted with what he had done, and I told him to go ahead, but I was delighted with it. So I came out of there, and I walked up the road. I was going up to the church to say a prayer of thanksgiving that I'd got the flat. And I passed this complex of six flats, and there was a vacant flat on the top floor. I thought, oh, that's lovely. So I went around to see him and I told him, and he said, sure, you can have it. And I said, no. I stood outside the church, he said, and I thought, well, I've given that man my word and I'm not going back on it.
Well, you were taking the half house,
taking
from.
The house from.
Yeah.
Because my father always told us, if you hadn't your word, you had nothing. And I thought, well, I've given that man my word, and I felt I would be letting down my own father if I didn't take the flat that I said I was going to take. And 3 weeks later I was going to work one morning and my block of little flats had had a direct hit from a bomb, and the nettles grew up through it, the rest of the war.
Had you any other near things, as it were?
Well, a few times. I was coming home from work one day, and the English planes were chasing German bombers. Fighters were after him, and I was going over a bridge, South Hall Bridge, cycling, and there was shrapnel falling all around me, and they were chasing him. And by the time I got to where I was living at Heston, he was dropping his bombs. Well, they were raining down all over the place. So I just ran in. Didn't know what to do with myself. Here I was in the middle of the day kind of thing, and bombs dropping everywhere. What am I going to do with myself? I said, I can't do anything here. So anyway, I went to where the smoke was and found plenty to do.
A lot of damage.
Yes, people killed, you know. All the sad things that happened. Chemist had just come in for his lunch, and his wife was giving him his dinner, and the children heard the noise of the planes, ran out in the garden to see it. Parents were killed inside, and the children escaped out in the garden. So they had a little bunch of children not knowing what had happened. They just heard all the noise and ran out. And things used to happen just that suddenly.
What about the buzz bombs, the B-1s and the B-2s? Were you there for those?
Indeed I was.
They were very frightening.
The V1s weren't so bad in one sense. You heard them coming.
They came in on a motor, and the motor then cut and they glided.
And they didn't come in on fine days because they could be seen. And they didn't come in on moonlit nights because they could be seen. So you had a little respite there. But then if the day was overcast, you had them coming continuously all day long. And the same with the nights, like if it was raining at night, well then they came in all the time. But you heard them coming, which wasn't so bad. At least, well, maybe you could take shelter or you could do something if you thought they were coming near you. But the V2s, you didn't hear them until after the explosion. So you had no idea that they were coming to get you.
Just add on that piece about the stillness before the don't make noise there, would you? You know what you were saying about sudden stillness, like before a tornado.
Oh yes, one morning I was going to work on my bicycle, and suddenly I felt I was the only person on the road. There was no cars, no bicycles, nothing, and the stillness was now like, you know, say like a tornado. There wasn't like an animal moving, nothing was moving. And I suddenly wondered what was wrong, and I said, well, there must be something wrong. So I got off my bike, and the only place I could go for shelter was down into a drain. And after standing there like a fool for a few minutes, I thought, well, if anybody comes along, they'll wonder what on earth I'm up to. The next thing was, in the distance I heard the crash, the explosion, where everybody else seemingly had heard the bomb cut out. And they had all taken immediate cover. I was cycling along happily, hadn't heard it, and I didn't know anything until the explosion. But even at work one day, we were coming back from the canteen from having a cup of tea, and suddenly one of the men came up behind me and sent me flying, and I was absolutely disgusted. You know, down on the ground like anything, flat on your face. And I turned my head round to give out to him, and this explosion was right behind us. He'd seemingly looked round, saw the bomb coming down, and as he was going down himself, so he got a hold of me and kind of walloped me down at the same time. But my husband was coming home from work one morning, it was after our baby was born, I think, and he and another very nice man, I knew him, they were on night work. They were cycling along, and they heard a bomb coming down. This was the ordinary bombs now at the time. And you were supposed to lie down on the road or the ground, wherever you were, and put your hands this way under your chest. Keep your stomach and chest up off the road so that you wouldn't get the vibration through your body. And after the explosion,
My husband got up, and he looked round at his friend, and he was lying there, blood pouring outside of his mouth. He was gone.
Well, when the war ended, did you come back to Ireland?
No, I came back before it ended. My husband was in the army then, and with the danger of the V2s, he'd been away in the army, not knowing when I was, what news I was going to get of him, because you'd hear all sorts of rumours and stories at times. And I thought, well, my baby's in Ireland, and I'm in the London, in the thick of the fire, and he's away, and I felt it wasn't fair to the baby if anything should happen to, you know, baby could lose both parents. There was no need, at least, for her to lose me, because I was there of my own free will. And I decided to come home and stay with her. And just the night before I left, the house I was staying in had almost a direct hit from one of the V2s. I took the landlady to the pictures, and when we were just seeing down the pictures a few minutes when the warning went up that a bomb had dropped in the area, and we came out and we came back to the house, and well, everything was in chaos. And round the corner, the next road, things were worse, because that was where it had fallen. And you see, those things were very light, metal, so that all the explosive just went out, it was all surface. It didn't make a crater in the ground. It would drop on the table, it wouldn't mark it, that kind of thing. You see, all the were very, very, very light metal in the casings. And I went into this house that I knew, there was no lady in it. And when I went in, I found her in what had been the kitchen. And she was standing on about 2 feet of rubble. And I was afraid that there might be gas escaping, you see. So I said, Granny, what are you doing in there? She says, I'm looking for the lid of the teapot to make my cup of tea in the morning. And her house had been damaged by a bomb a short time before that, another one of the V2s. And the ceilings had come down, and it put plasterboard ceilings up. Everybody nearly had a plasterboard ceilings, at least in the London area anyway, by the time it was over. And her bed was on the floor by the wall, a single bed. She just had the mattress on the floor. And when the plasterboard came down, it went tent fashion. And it protected her from all the rubble.
The rubble, yes.
And then when it was all over, she crawled out. And she was out in the kitchen looking for the lid of the teapot. And her front door was about 300 yards down the road in somebody else's garden. Gone completely. Somebody came looking to know where number 25 was.
They had the door.
Oh, was that it? They had the door. And Granny did not leave that house that night. Her home was her castle, and she was going to stay there.
Just to bring you on a bit, tell me about the shop then, when you started that.
Oh, yes. Well, after my husband came home from England, there was nothing to do.
It was after the war.
There was no jobs to be got. And he got tired knocking around the country, so he decided to come to Dublin and see if he could find anything in Dublin. We were looking for little farms or anything to buy, and couldn't find anything. Anybody who had anything weren't inclined to sell. Nobody knew exactly what to do at that stage. And he came up to Dublin, and he went up to Glen Cree cutting turf. And while he was up there, one of the men up there told him about this little shop in South Richmond Street that was for sale.
That's down in Kelly's Corner.
Down at Kelly's Corner, yeah. So we bought it. And we started up very, very small, because there was very little in that shop when I went into it.
Grocery shop. Of course, you still had rationing at that time.
I had no idea, you see, I had no idea of grocery business. Just went in and bought this place. And I found that most of the things that were on the shelves were dummies. 1 dozen of rotten eggs. I got rid of it in one row, I assure you. And 1 packet of Persil. Cost 7.5 for the packet of Persil. That 1 packet of Persil, that meant I could get 1 coupon. That was on coupon. So I could get 1 coupon to start me off. You couldn't buy a box of parcel without having enough coupons for to cover the whole box. But that was a slow start. But of course the coupon business was another business altogether. I mean, the shops in the country took all the coupons out of the books. Anybody coming up to Dublin from the country had no coupons when they came to Dublin. So then the fellas who were with my husband up on the mountain, they were up there before he went there. He told me they had literally nothing to eat up there. After a day's work on the bog in the daytime, you used to have to go down to the valley and get the women down in the valleys around Glencree to bake a cake of bread for them. And then they threw it back up the mountain again with that. They had no meat, except in cases run a hare or a rabbit to ground and take them practically all day to do that. And no cigarettes, no nothing. They might get a few cigarettes sometimes down in the pub at the foot of the mountain or whatever. So I decided to take on looking after them, if possible. It was a big undertaking, but gradually I began to get food up to them. The lorries used to go up from the city in the morning with the workers. And they used to call to the shop. And they used to bring up the food. Landy's had a bakery out in Rathfarnham then, and they used to deliver us the bread about before 7 in the morning, hot. And we'd pack that into sacks and put that on the lorries going up in the morning.
How many men were there up there?
Oh, I have no idea. There must have been about maybe 8 or 9 camps of them up there. And we did each camp like separate.